Welcome to democracyonthemove.org, a podcast tribute to the people and organizations who dare to reimagine our nation and drive it toward its true democratic principles. Content for this episode was recorded on Wednesday, March 3, 2021. I'm Dan Schaefer, your host for today's podcast, and thank you for joining us today. Today we're talking with Sean Diller, board president of an organization known as Heartland Strong. Heartland Strong believes that the ability of Americans to come together to solve the tough problems has always been a part of our national identity. But they also believe that our political leaders today have failed to confront the crises that we face, that they prioritize the will of big donors and political insiders ahead of their constituents. As a result, Heartland Strong is taking the initiative to advocate for some progressive ideas such as a rapid transition to a net zero carbon economy, universal access to mental health and medical care, and critical community resilience investments for the uncertain future ahead. So, Sean Diller, welcome to Democracy on the Move, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, could you give us a brief history of Heartland Strong, and specifically, you know, who's in the group, what are they doing, why it's needed, and how long this organization has been around?
So Heartland Strong has been around for just under 2 years now. And in terms of the who, our board members are myself, Brian Strubig, who is a rural business accountant and deck builder and handyman of all kinds on big projects around the Lake of the Ozarks, a former candidate for state senate in Missouri. And then a longtime family friend, Rachel Winograd, who is actually Dr. Rachel Winograd. She's a PhD in addiction research. She's done a lot of really great work around opioids. And it started with, you know, people I knew who, you know, there's just this disconnect between what the national political parties are doing and what people really need, especially in the heartland and especially in, you know, rural areas. I think are seeing some really acute pain from the policy failures. But as soon as I say that, you know, urban areas and places where they've had single party rule from the Democrats are a lot of times facing the same problems. Yeah. So we really wanted to bridge those divides, and big money in politics, the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, Citizens United, and gerrymandering, a lot of these different forces are kind of more destructive to democracy, I think, than they have been in the past. And a lot of these court cases are somewhat recent. And so we saw a need for a membership organization that could talk to people outside of the partisan political discussion. Because at the end of the day, you know, I think that people want the same things, and we're more polarized about politics than anything else.
Yeah. Well, that's true. And so here it is, though. Heartland Strong is a progressive force from the heartland. And that is, it's a rural-based, politically progressive organization. And so for a guy like me, I'm a city folk myself, and city folk, we tend to think of our fellow rural Americans as being highly conservative. You know, one look at any political map, especially maps that cover the Midwest, right? Missouri, Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, and so on. There's just red all over the place with tiny spots of blue for the metropolitan areas. And so I associate the word progressive with the color blue, but apparently that's not the case. So can you enlighten me on this disconnect?
When I think of what progressivism is about, rural people, and, you know, I grew up in a rural community, a small town of under 5,000 people, and I lived 5 miles outside of town. My grandparents on my mom's side were tenant farmers, and I saw how hard they worked on the farm through their 70s. And then, you know, like a lot of farm families, just to make ends meet, they had jobs off the farm. So my grandma and grandpa at 75 years old were cleaning Sprint telephone offices in tiny towns throughout Missouri, those little cinder block buildings that might see. And even doing that, you know, they had no benefits. She was a 1099 contractor. So if she slipped on a wet floor, you know, there was nothing for her. And so in these problems, especially among wage earners, they're urban and rural problems. And, you know, the culture wars around politics, you know, I think of it as the three B's: babies, bullets, and the Bible. You know, I think that has been a really useful message for Republicans in rural areas. And I think the Democrats have gotten progressively less effective at fighting against it in rural areas specifically.
Sure.
You know, but I think people do want these problems addressed. You know, the problems have gotten worse than they were before. We see people without clean water, not just in Texas, but all over the place. Mm-hmm. And so that shouldn't be a Republican or Democratic issue, especially at the local levels, county levels, and state legislative levels in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is interesting that you talk about your grandparents being part of what we would now call the gig economy. And that it really is kind of a ripoff for the workers because they don't get any of the guarantees. Like you say, you slip on a wet floor, that's it. You know, you're going to go bankrupt with medical bills and so on. So this is, it cuts across parties, I think, these types of discussions. So what other progressive concepts are popular in the Heartland?
So, you know, the governor of Oklahoma a year or so ago let 400 or 500 prisoners loose because, mm-hmm. you know, locking people up for nonviolent offenses is not consistent with freedom, you know, and it's not consistent with fiscal conservatism. Mm-hmm. And so criminal justice reform is absolutely an issue, and not even just with regard to incarceration, but with regard to marijuana legalization, how we treat addiction, and mm-hmm. and paid leave is also something that we've seen gain traction in among Republicans in Congress and Republicans at the state level. You know, people who welcome a new member into the family mm-hmm. by having a baby or adopting a baby mm-hmm. or someone getting sick. You know, that's not a Republican or Democratic issue. People want a response because it's gotten so bad. It calls for a response.
Yeah. But the you mentioned fiscal conservatism. That really gets me interested, because just a little anecdote here. My brother, he's very conservative, very red conservative, very much a Trump supporter. And I remember, you know, before COVID, we used to get together a lot more than we do now, but we get together once in a while and talk politics. And he would approach me as if I'm some sort of liberal person. And I said, look, I says, I'm conservative. And his eyes are popping out of his head. I says, yeah, I'm conservative. I says, I'm socially progressive, you know, but I'm fiscally conservative. And it was like I was speaking a different language to him. And it's that way with a lot of people too, because they are so used to this this duopoly that we have, where if you're going to be conservative, that means you're going to be Republican. Republicans really aren't that fiscally conservative, by the way. But that really means more conservative from a social perspective. And so having this combination of being progressive and being conservative at the same time seems to be a dichotomy, but it really isn't.
Right. And
yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just saying, yeah. And you know, you're not a unicorn in that sense. Mm-hmm. I think it is a super interesting discussion because you can really, really pull on the thread. You know, Georgia is not a socially liberal state. Mm-hmm. And they voted for Democrats for the United States Senate and for the for the White House. And so, you know, I think the nationalization of the debate just really being pushed by whoever's the loudest, and that, you know, social media driven politics mm-hmm. and politics, frankly, that are driven from the coast, I think is another part of it. A lot of folks do get lost in the mix and they don't feel like either party is really speaking to them. And that's when we get someone like Donald Trump being able to cobble together a coalition of,
right,
you know, 3 million people less than Hillary, but get into the White House while the Republicans are able to ride those coattails, at least in 2016 a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that Trump has been able to do, though, is speak to those people that feel that they are being left behind. You know, the classic flyover state sort of feeling. I mean, that very phrase, flyover state, means that, well, they're just ignoring us. Everything's being run from the coasts. And mm-hmm. Trump, for better or for worse, I don't think he actually delivered on his rhetoric, but he certainly would speak to people as if they were, speaking to them with a sense of respect. I mean, let's set aside all the racial things that he did, which were horrible, but he did speak to people in the rural areas pretty strongly. And
yeah.
But that also gets me, we can talk about this too, because there's this dilemma, because and there's this book called Let Them Eat Tweets. It's from Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson. And they talk about this thing called the conservative dilemma. And the conservative dilemma is this. It poses a question. It says, how can we consolidate power and money in the hands of the few when the votes are in the hands of the many?
Right.
And so what the, at least according to this book anyways, what the approach there for the Republicans at this point, could just as well be the Democrats, but it's the Republicans at this point, the approach is to divide people up so that they're voting not on their fiscal issues, like, you know, hospitals closing and the gig economy issues we talked about before, but they're voting mm-hmm. on their social issues. You know, let's divide them up on Second Amendment rights. Let's divide the people up on flag burning, or let's divide them up on abortion or things like that, which weren't issues, you know, prior to the 1980s, really. But now they've become right. issues because it's a way to divide people up and get them to vote against their own fiscal interests. But hopefully, or at least what they're trying to do is make them vote for their social issues.
Right. No, you're totally right. And I think that's the tension you see in the GOP, you know, with the actions to suppress voters. And in Trump's case, completely throw out the election, disenfranchising, you know, all the voters who voted for the rightful winner. Mm-hmm. And it is about consolidating power among a few individuals. And, you know, that flaw does creep into all institutions, I think. And mm-hmm. I think that's been an influence on the Democratic Party that's kept it from more forcefully calling for some of these issues that they could use as successful wedges against the Republicans. Mm-hmm. Instead, just ceding the territory and letting the chips fall where they may.
Well, I think I've heard this on Meet the Press. I think it was Chuck Todd. I mean, he may not be the person that said this, but he said something to the effect of that the Republicans go for the jugular and the Democrats go for the capillaries.
right. Yeah.
And I think what it is too is that there's a certain element of being a bully in the Republican Party these days. They relish in being a bully, and the Democrats, as insouciant as they may be toward, you know, everybody else, they're not willing to go that extra step and actually fully commit to this bipartisanship firing ammunition back when they're being fired upon themselves.
Yeah. So. Yeah. This idea, this quality of being seen as being reasonable, mm-hmm. Is one that Democrats prize more. Yeah. And, you know, the elections go the way the elections go, you know, but you're totally right. You know, Republicans, I think, just revel in seeing their guy or their gal just throw, you know, rabbit punches and, mm-hmm. you know, just all the dirty tricks. Because that helps their side win. And we just really want to be right, you know, on the Democratic and kind of progressive side. And, you know, I've worked on Democratic campaigns, but the organization is really about pushing the Democrats and pushing the Republicans to be better. So, you know, I think of myself as more aligned with the Democrats, but, mm-hmm. but yeah, I think that's something where they've fallen short.
Okay. Well, so I guess to that degree, We talked basically, actually, it says right on your site, it says much ink has been spilled about voters supporting conservative politicians who directly oppose their core interests while supporting progressive ballot initiatives. I mean, that this plays right into that discussion there. But let's see how this plays out, though. Let's talk about education in Missouri here. We talked a little bit before the podcast, before we started talking on the podcast here, we talked a little bit about education and what's going on. It's going on here in Missouri, but it's also going on in other states, the invasion of what I would call a charter school invasion. And Could you kind of comment on what the rural take is on charter schools and what's really going on there?
Yeah. So the issue in my head, and for a lot of the more vocal interest groups that are, you know, that you might be hearing opinions about, you know, I think the reason that politicians and people involved in public schools are so upset about charter schools is because they see it as a direct threat to public school funding, and mm-hmm. public schools are already devastatingly underfunded. And, you know, we see it in urban schools as well as rural schools, especially when you start to look for funding for students with special needs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what I'm seeing in Missouri is kind of the beginning of what will become a fully just a raging battle, I think, in the mm-hmm. state.
Yeah.
And one that I think that the charter school proponents are poised to win, just based on kind of what you were talking about with the politicization of these issues in rural areas. And parents, you know, see it as choice. So, you know, politically, it's not a great issue for progressives unless they're able to really make the case that your kids are going to be harmed by this disruption in funding.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you know, I think we will see our public schools continue to be undermined, and we've seen it for years and years. I think the Republicans see public school teachers, public employee unions, and public education in general as a powerful block in the Democratic coalition, and therefore worth attacking with everything they've got.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the parents and the kids pay the price. It's not about good outcomes for kids, this debate. It's about politics.
Yeah.
And that's what's really upsetting.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is driven by lobbyists too, because I read one of the articles on your website, heartlandstrong.org, and that talks extensively about charter schools, and they had a lot of good references in there, and the failure rate of these charter schools. Some of them don't even open up their doors, but they're still pulling down a lot of money. They can pull down several $1 million and in the end never open up their doors. And so what happens, even if they do open up their doors, they take the students in, and then if they close their doors, like, you know, a year later or whatever, where do those students go? Well, there's this safety net known as the public school system, which, by the way, has less money now because we've wasted all this money with the charter schools. But it continues to go. You know, it becomes a situation where, as I said in the introduction, one of the mission statements of Heartland Strong says, you know, our politicians really aren't paying attention to us anymore. They're really sort of talking to lobbyists and talking to, you know, their big donors and not really paying attention to their constituents.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of the sort of extremist right-wing legislators who often represent rural districts, they're not even, you know, their defense for supporting the proposals are that it's not going to come here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that illustrates who they're talking to.
Yeah. Well, it does come out to the rural areas, though, because the state will have a budget for education, right? And if some of that budget, and I'm not an accountant, so you'll have to school me on this one here, but some of that budget is going to end up going to the charter schools, even though it's not even in the area of the rural schools. It's just the fact that the state is now spending more money on basically private industry schools.
Right. Yeah. And the goal for the outcome for the folks pushing this, really this, you know, every charter school is an experiment, honestly, mm-hmm. just like you said, even if there are standards, what if they don't meet the standards? I know the kids are going to be a year older. I don't know what happens to the charter school, you know, mm-hmm. and you're right. You know, when the goal for the outcome is to have per pupil spending follow the pupil into a charter school if they leave a public school, and mm-hmm. and that's the mechanism by which the public schools really will see their money disappear.
Yeah. Mm. And also, let's talk about healthcare. That's also on one of your part of your mission statement in Missouri here. And I just happened to look this up. I've been aware of this for a while, but I looked up more specific information regarding healthcare in Missouri. We've seen a number of rural hospitals and health clinics shut down over the past 5 years. In the 8th Congressional District, which covers much of southern Missouri, there have been 5 closures of rural hospitals since 2016. And the 8th District Representative, I'll call him out by name, Jason Smith, complained that rural hospitals are closing in part because they're not getting reimbursed at the same levels as the hospitals in the big cities. Now, the extent of my research there is to go to my wife and ask her if that's true, because she worked at a hospital recently. And she says, yeah, that is true, but it's more complicated than that, but that's part of the truth. So, but I believe that actually oversimplifies the problem. It nevertheless mystifies me why Representative Smith opposes Medicaid expansion, which could bring more dollars into the state, into the hospitals. And I understand, you know, Medicaid has a reimbursement rate that is somewhat less than the actual expense. However, that Medicaid is what's coming in from the federal government. It gets supplemented with state and other sources as well. So I don't know why he would oppose that. Is this one of those phenomenons where, you know, we're seeing our elected officials, even though they placate us with these social messages, but they're really not doing that much for us fiscally?
Yeah. I mean, when I read that, I was just thinking, it sounds like an excuse and not really an answer that a congressman owes his constituents who are wondering where they're going to go to the hospital. So, I mean, I think you're right. He should be supportive of funding Medicaid and funding hospitals and making sure that people don't forego care because they know they can't afford the copay, or they know they can't afford the knee brace that the doctor is going to say that they need. You know, I think Heartland Strong, you know, this is a great example of what Heartland Strong can do on the issues. You know, we're set up as a advocacy organization, so not a political action committee that's focused 100% on elections, but an advocacy organization that's really focused on advancing better policy. And so simply by virtue of just shaking off some of these partisan labels, you know, we're not the Democratic Party when we talk to Republican voters about, hey, you should call Representative Smith and ask him what he's doing to fix this problem. And he will listen to Republican voters because he knows that his political future is based on his prospects within the Republican Party and within his district, not based on, you know, what is catching lots of retweets or what's trending on HuffPo.
But a lot of times, I mean, one of the problems that these congressional people have, and I don't know if Representative Jason Smith is one of them, but I suspect he is. They spend a lot of their time in Washington, D.C., dialing for dollars and talking to their donors. So they don't really get much of an opportunity to take input directly from their constituents. A lot of times they can take their constituents for granted. Especially when you have gerrymandered districts and so on. I mean, this is a real tough uphill battle. Which brings me to Heartland Strong, because I'm very excited about your group, by the way. I really like what you guys are doing. And in your website, it says, you know, you're running digital heavy campaigns to impact key Heartland state electoral politics and public opinion in a targeted way that no other group is doing. And my only observation there is, boy, I hope you can do it. But you're up against a billion dollar plus marketing machine known as the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, the duopoly, basically. They have their own messaging that they're pushing out there. And so your messaging, even though it really is, advocates for the people, for the rural people. It's a tall order when you're going up against, you know, all this dark money and money from donors. Can you give us some ideas of what your approach is to overcome this this obstacle?
Yeah. So I thought of a couple of examples to analogize, and the one I liked the best was of the Kansas City Royals.
Okay, that'll be a good one. I'll listen to that one.
Yeah. So I was born in 1985 when the Royals were a powerhouse franchise. You know, led by George Brett, Brett Saberhagen, and lots of other great athletes. And they won the World Series. And that's the year I was born. And they didn't win the World Series again until I was 30.
Wow.
And,
at least you aren't between, a Cubs fan. You'd have to wait 100 years, but go ahead.
Right. And so, you know, I thought about the players and the coaches and the 162 game season. And, you know, there are lots of different matchups and you build a team over years and you'll win some and you lose some. Mm-hmm. But my perspective is one that's based in, you know, I grew up in the Catholic Church. I grew up in scouting, and service is something that's always driven me. And social justice is something that's always driven me. And, you know, when it comes to the political outcomes of elections, you know, that's not something we have to be 100% focused on, because the reality is in every 2-year election cycle, say 24 months, 20 or 21 of those months are the primary. Mm-hmm. Meaning that Republicans are talking with Republicans about who's going to lead their party into the general election, and same with Democrats. Right. And so that's when we can, you know, really notch some wins by, you know, on the digital side, specifically the campaign that we're working on launching soon is around CAFOs, confined area feeding mm-hmm. operations.
Yep.
And, you know, framing the cause is really a huge part of getting past the barriers that you said, which is the billions of dollars being spent by the Republican and the Democratic Party and their supporting organizations. Because the problem is that if the national party has written off your county, then they're not going to be talking about clean water in your county, even though you deserve to have clean water. And even though, you know, your Republican state legislator might be persuaded with enough phone calls to, you know, not let a stinking manure factory park in that district. And so, you know, by targeting geographically, by targeting around the issue, you know, very visceral, local, impactful causes that people understand how mm-hmm. they connect to it. You know, I think digital is really good for that. And I think, you know, we will be able to have real outcomes on people's lives without turning red states and all the red counties blue. Mm-hmm. You know, we can have better Republicans. I know it might be hard to imagine.
Actually, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, you can. Absolutely.
And to that end, you know, we will probably end up endorsing Adam Kinzinger in Illinois, in his Republican primary. whether we endorse him in the general, we don't know. But that's a race that we might have something to bring to the table.
Yeah. You know, classically Republicans, and I would say up until like the 1960s, they were very progressive. I mean, going way back to the first Republican president, you know, everybody talks about Abe Lincoln, right? Being the, you know, the emancipation, women's suffrage, organized labor. Go and look at, he's actually on the website at Democracy on the Move. Take a look at fighting Bob La Follette, who is a Wisconsin senator back in the earlier part of the 20th century. Very progressive on social issues, and yet still conservative on fiscal issues as well. So this really was a, when you say there are good Republicans or there's hope for Republicans, I absolutely believe that. I think it's in our blood to do that. And I think most democratic societies out there are at their heart conservative in terms of fiscal matters, but yet you know, to be successful you have to be progressive on social issues. I mean, it's just I believe that in my whole heart. So I believe it's a good cause which you're fighting there. You talked about the CAFOs; those are the factory farms. We've talked about those before on the podcast here. This is specifically, I think it was Senate Bill 391, which passed, I think it was 2019 or 2019, I believe. Maybe it's 2020, but it was basically, it took local control away from the counties. You know, the counties could no longer issue their own standards for regulating these factory farms. So literally now they can dump basically poop 50 feet away from your house, 300 feet away from a drinking well.
And your county is powerless to make rules against it.
Right. They're powerless. And this also sort of dovetails, too, with more Senate bills. We talked about education earlier. Senate Bill 55, which is up this year, wants to basically take a lot of control away from local school boards and consolidate them into the state level. So what I'm seeing at least on the Republican side of things, is a more of a consolidation of power. And it used mm-hmm. to be just the opposite. It used to be more liberal. You know, that's let the local people come up with their own local solutions. And
right.
So this is a really alarming trend. And I hope that you guys are able to convince people in the rural areas that, you know, this is what's happening literally in their backyards, and they're supporting right. this. So,
right.
Good.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to say, one more thing I was going to add on that in terms of the, the digital campaigns and the difference between what we are going to be doing online compared to the Democrats and the Republicans. You know, ask Chuck Schumer or ask John Kerry or ask Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, what is the reason to ban livestock production in any state in the United States? And they might say something about how CH4 is a really harmful climate gas, mm-hmm. even more harmful than the other climate gases.
Yeah, methane,
and
yeah.
mm-hmm. we'll tell you that if this CAFO starts up, your property value is going to drop.
Yeah.
And the air around you is going to smell like cow manure.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a different conversation, but, you know, and it's one that needs to be scaled. And I think it's one that the Republicans have, you know, these ideas aren't coming from constituents. It's just like you said, you know, they're coming from lobbyists. They're coming from huge interest groups and from high level officers who are saying, you know, hey, see if they'll swallow this law.
Yeah.
And I think the reason is so that Democrats are really playing whack-a-mole. You know, how are Democrats going to put together Democrats like Crystal Quaid and Peter Meredith and, you know, these great leaders that are in the Missouri legislature? How are they going to put together the paid leave coalition when they have 15 insane bills from mm-hmm. Republicans that they're having to fight against?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a failure of the two-party system.
Yeah. Speaking of insane bills, I think it's SB 66, the one that it got national attention, but I don't think it's going to pass anything. But it basically says you can run over protesters.
Right.
That's a very trivial way of putting it. It's not quite that simple, but basically if somebody's blocking the road and they're protesting, and if they get hit, then the driver's not at fault or something like that. It was
right.
This is supposed
to be a democracy, you know, like that's yeah. all we can do is make our voice heard in legislators' offices by phone calls, postcards, showing up, doing sit-ins, doing protests.
Mm-hmm.
And organizing people. And, you know, there's nothing conservative about trying to make it so that protesters are afraid for their lives.
Yeah.
And that violent people can yeah. run rampant.
Well, a lot of talk about the Second Amendment, but the right to protest is your First Amendment. So, you know, we have to be concerned about all the amendments. So we talked a lot about the political parties. Is Heartland, I'm sure the answer is no, but I'm going to ask anyways, is Heartland Strong affiliated with any political party?
So we are not affiliated with any political parties. And as a 501c4 organization, we're most like a labor union or like the Sierra Club, an organization like that. So we okay. might be more likely to support progressive candidates or Democratic candidates than Republican candidates, but not affiliated with the party.
Okay, good. So let's wrap it up here. I just want to do a call to action section. What can our listeners do to get more involved, learn more about Heartland Strong?
Yeah, absolutely. So definitely if folks can listen to the Heartland Pod, it's a great podcast. It can get a little long. So we have a shorter version that's just news roundup. It's called The Flyover View. Mm-hmm. So our podcasts come out on Mondays and Fridays, and you can support our work by donating, of course, at heartlandstrong.org. And, you know, we are a membership organization. So we're driven by a big mission that, you know, I want my kids and my grandkids to be able to have a safe, prosperous life in the United States and in the heartland. And that's what we're working on. And, you know, we're not beholden to specific policy ideals, except we want to lift people up. We want people to be more resilient, and, you know, we want more people to run for office. And so, you know, listen to what we're going to be doing for the next, you know, all through this cycle. We're going to be doing a ton of community organizing mm-hmm. events finally again, and the podcast. So, yeah. heartlandstrong.org.
I did a little bit of homework and listened to the podcast, and I like the DJ. Who's this guy? I forgot what his name was now.
That's Adam Summer. He's a prominent Missouri attorney, and he helms the podcast. Wow. We're coming up on, I think, we've gotten over 6,000 total downloads in just a handful of months being on the air.
So. Oh, man, you guys got me beat. You know, he has a great voice. I really enjoyed listening to him. So, and interesting. Good, well, yeah, thanks. It is a little bit long, but you play it on 2X, and you can get through it in, you know, in 90 minutes rather than, or in 45 minutes rather than 90 minutes. But it's all very interesting, though, and I enjoyed it. So, again, that website is Heartland Strong. It's all one word, heartlandstrong.org. And thank you, Sean. We've been talking with Sean Diller, board president of Heartland Strong. And thanks, Sean, for all the great work that you're doing. Keep it up. And thank you for joining us today to tell us about Heartland Strong.
Thank you so much, Dan. Good to be with you.
You've been listening to Democracy on the Move, a tribute to all those people and organizations who dare to reimagine our nation and drive it back to its true democratic principles. Please tune in each week where we will feature guests and topics that will help keep you in touch with our march toward a more perfect union. If you have any suggestions or stories that you think we should be covering at Democracy on the Move, please contact us through our website contact page at democracyonthemove.org/contact or send us an email at info@democracyonthemove.org. You can also comment on our Twitter page at All on the Move. If you find today's podcast interesting and informative, please tell your friends and family about us. And if you would like to help sponsor the podcast at Democracy on the Move, please contact us through the website or email. I'm Dan Schaefer, producer of the podcast, and I'd like to thank you for tuning in. It's been my pleasure to be with you today. Please have a safe week ahead, and we hope you'll tune in to our next show.